The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth. As the vaccination programme picks up pace, concerns are growing over the South African variant of COVID. The government has said that the number of cases in the UK that they have identified has grown to 147, while new data, only a small sample, on the Oxford vaccine suggests it had a low effect or low efficacy when it came to tackling mild to moderate illness. James, just to, I suppose, set the scene here, how genuine is the concern or grave over the South African variant? It's still a small number of cases. The sample is we're being told we shouldn't read too much into it. So what is the level of concern?
So, I mean, there is obviously concern because this is a variant that the vaccine appears to be ineffective against in terms of stopping you from getting kind of mild or moderately sick. The Oxford team still seem quite confident that it will stop you from ending up in hospital or from dying from COVID. But I think it is a worry. I think there is a sense that because the Kentish variant is so transmissible, the South African variant is unlikely to become the kind of dominant strain in the UK. But I think what is causing concern is the sense that this might not be a purely South African phenomenon. You might see the virus evolving in this way as a kind of survival mechanism in other places. And obviously, if you fuse together kind of higher transmissibility with this other mutation, that would be particularly worrying and problematic. So I think this does highlight the worries about a vaccine evading variant. And I was thinking also it is a big question now as to whether this increased testing capacity and all the money spent on test and trace, whether that can enable you to get on top of a mutation like this that, as you say, we have 147 cases of in the UK. Does the UK now have the ability to properly and rigorously contact trace to slow and stop the spread?
Isabel, we've got surge testing underway in areas where a case was identified of the South African variant. But yet, one of the tools which many think is going to help in terms of stopping the arrival or further spread of the South African variant is to have stricter quarantine. Where are we at on quarantine hotels? Because we've been told they will be in place, but if you flew on an indirect flight from South Africa to the UK today, you would not have to quarantine in a hotel, is that right?
Yeah, so the quarantine hotels don't start until the 15th of February, and it's not the case that all travellers will be subject to these quarantine measures. There's a number of countries where the strains have been found, the South African variant and other strains, but which aren't on that quarantine list. So we saw at the end of last week, Labour saying that the current quarantine policy and a lot of the delays over the quarantine policy as well were risking people's lives. And I think politically we're going to see a lot more on this about whether it's possible to lock the borders down more strictly. Boris Johnson at PMQs last week was saying that it wasn't possible to close the borders completely. But the argument from the government's critics is that the government's moving too slowly with what it's doing. And you've had a lot of stories involving hotel chains saying that they haven't been approached properly or they haven't been given the right equipment and so on to prepare for this quarantine hotel policy. So it looks like it could be the next big government mess that's already happening, but that's going to get much messier.
James, what I'm struggling with, perhaps you can help me, is given the government could be doing more on the South African variant, is it fair to say that they don't mind there being a few cases of it in the country? It's just that they don't want this to get out of hand? Or is it the case that they want to have zero South African COVID variant?
One of the lessons of this crisis has been that the UK stopped attempting to trace contacts of the first few set of COVID cases back a year or so ago. And I think it'd be a massive mistake to repeat that error again. With the
increased number of testing capacity the UK now has. The aim surely should be to try and get right on top of this South African variant. I also think, though, that given the way in which the changes to the spike protein appear to be happening, you are probably looking at a situation where most of the vulnerable people in this country are going to end up having three COVID jabs this year. So, you know, two jabs as part of a normal process, and then a third booster shot designed to help them with the South African variant.
Now, meanwhile, Isabel, we have had an intervention from Labour today. Rachel Reeves, Michael Gove's opposite number, has been talking about cronyism and contracts and ultimately attacking the government for some of the early handling of COVID in terms of who got what. Can you talk us through the attack, and is it made harder by the fact that we recently had a success story in vaccines?
I think that vaccine line will be the retort that the Conservatives will offer to this intervention from Rachel Reeves. And we've seen that quite a lot from Boris Johnson at Prime Minister's Questions. Whenever Keir Starmer has questioned a certain contract, Boris Johnson's argument has been, oh, he just doesn't like the private sector at all, but look at the success of the vaccine task force. He wouldn't have gone for that policy and we wouldn't have had the same level of success. So I suppose you can already imagine what the government's response to this Reeves speech is going to be. Now, she's basically saying that the government has spent more than £2 billion of taxpayers' money on products and services provided by firms with a financial or personal connection to the Conservative Party. So this is the crony virus, as some people have been calling it. Companies employing Conservative MPs as consultants or who have got spouses of Conservative MPs at the helm and so on. And Reeves is accusing the government of basically using that fast track system that it put up in order to get, for instance, PPE into the country as quickly as possible, that fast track system actually favoured friends or donors and so on. I think another reason that Labour is focusing on this is, again, the vaccination programme, in that things have gone so well on that front for the government so far that the Labour Party has to find another line of attack. And so the idea that actually that rouse of the pandemic, sort of an earlier stage of the pandemic, particularly around PPE, is something that they think is probably more fruitful for them to focus on. But it is difficult because to a certain extent, things have moved on. And this is the great fear of a lot of people in Labour, that as more people get vaccinated, the feeling about the government will change. And we've already seen in the polls that it's changing already, the government's handling of the pandemic, and that people will start to perhaps even forget, maybe forgive some of the early errors in this pandemic. And therefore, Labour will have to work out a whole new line of attack against a government that's back in favour again.
James, you've heard a few accounts recently of a commentators criticising Keir Starmer, but also Labour MPs beginning to voice concerns privately, but you're beginning to sense a bit more of unease. What is the number 10 view in terms of Keir Starmer? Do you think that he is someone who crosses their minds several times a day in terms of what will Keir say to this? Or do you think actually, just in the way that Labour don't often appear to be in the main debates, it's an afterthought?
No, look, I think Keir Starmer is clearly a more formidable opponent than Jeremy Corbyn was. And, you know, I think he takes up a kind of good chunk of number 10's political time thinking about him. I think it is true that there is less concern about him now that the government appears to have a vaccine policy that is progressing more smoothly. I think, you know, I think probably the SNP and the Scottish independence threat is probably something that worries them more right now than the question of Labour and Keir Starmer. But I think, you know, that can all change very quickly. I think there is I think the current polls, which is tending to show a Tory lead at the moment, and the Tory poll number growing, is causing some reassurance. But, you know, one of the things we've learned in this crisis is that things can change very quickly. I think that at the moment, the government looks competent because of the success of the vaccine rollout. But as Isabel said, you know, Labour's attempt to change the conversation back to PPE is an attempt to say, look, remember there was a time when the government spent, you know, the National Audit Office reckoned £10 billion more than they should have done on PPE. Now, I think the public are inclined to cut them a certain amount of slack on some of this. But I think Isabel's right to highlight it is this preferred bidder's line that is going to route, which is going to cause some problems. People are going to ask why there was a VIP lane for government procurement. And that is, I think the answer actually kind of relates to the kind of total panic there was about the need to get hold of PPE. But it is still going to be something that I think will be hard and difficult for the government to explain.
Now, finally, we're shaping up to an important few weeks in Scotland when it comes to the Samud inquiry. Isabel, we've heard today that Alex Salmond will not appear at the Holyrood inquiry on the government's handling of harassment complaints tomorrow, as had previously been planned. What's behind this?
Yeah, so that inquiry session has been called off, and he's been arguing with the Holyrood committee over what material regarding this inquiry can be published. He wants a submission that he made to a different investigation on Nicola Sturgeon breaking the ministerial code to be published. And he claims in this submission that Sturgeon has repeatedly misled the Scottish Parliament. And the Holyrood committee officials do not want to publish this submission. And Salmond was basically holding out on confirming his appearance, which was due tomorrow, and has now said that he will not be attending that committee meeting.
James, the Salmond inquiry, is it something that could put Nicola Sturgeon's position in jeopardy? Or actually, are we seeing that in terms of the Scottish Parliament, in terms of the evidence they're willing to accept and so forth, perhaps it doesn't quite have the teeth to get so much into those issues?
I think that Nicola Sturgeon's supporters feel the fact that Alex Salmond isn't appearing before this Holyrood committee is a sign that he doesn't have a kind of knockout piece of evidence against her. But I think if you watched any of Peter Murrell, the chief executive of the SNP's testimony this morning, some of these questions are not going to go away. And I think you can also see that there it will undoubtedly, if an inquiry was to find that Nicola Sturgeon had broken the ministerial code, that would obviously be difficult for her. Now, her personal popularity in Scotland right now is much greater than Alex Salmond's. And I think her supporters will hope that this sense will carry her through. But I think it's not easy. And I also think the other question is, you know, we saw with the, what you were writing about last week, Katie, with the tensions in the SNP with Joanne Cherry's sacking from the Westminster front bench. You know, there is a question, you know, how much longer can the SNP be held together? You know, these divisions about the right approach to trying to get a second independence referendum, transgender rights and all of these issues. Because ultimately, you know, divided parties rarely succeed in politics. And the SNP have been striking for how united they have been in recent years. But, you know, if these tensions carry on like this, you do begin to wonder what might happen.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Isabel. And thank you for listening.